Welcome to the CodeCast Podcast. Real-world insights for your daily medical coding and billing processes. And now, here's your host, Terry Fletcher.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 34 of the CodeCast Podcast. My name is Terry Fletcher, and we're halfway through June. And we just want to tell everybody thank you for listening in and making us number one on iTunes. Also, if you are on any of the platforms like that that allow you to rate us, we would appreciate a rating. Just keeps us engaged and gives us a little bit of statistical information so we know how you feel about the program, the content, and what we're doing out there. So we appreciate everybody that's been engaged with us and our listeners. So today I actually only have one sponsor. They're going to basically sponsor the entire show, so we appreciate that. It's a new sponsor. They wanted to be all about the show. And they're called Idea City. That's IDEACITY. And it says, the brightest minds, the biggest ideas. If it's new, if it's hot, if it will challenge your thinking, it's Idea City. So innovation, creativity, design, and tech. They're out of Toronto, Canada, and at IdeaCity.ca. So you can find them also on Twitter at Idea City. And so they have about 40,000 followers. So we appreciate them for sponsoring the entire program today. And we'll mention a couple things that they're doing coming up. They have a world conference coming up on June 20th that you can stream live on social media. So we'll just take a look at that later on, and we'll get started today. So again, my topic today, from what I want to talk about, I'm going to talk about some simple mistakes and daily processes that really can cost you money and revenue and reimbursement, and we don't want to do that. We're all about finding those revenue opportunities. And so when we look at some of these common mistakes, we have to be mindful that just some little tweaks, some little things that happen within your practice, and I just call them, you know, simple mistakes in your daily processes, can make all the difference in the world. Now, some are coding, some are documentation issues, and some are things you may not have really thought about, but can affect your patient satisfaction as well. And so I just really want to kind of bring some things to your attention, and maybe you can think, oh, okay, I didn't even think about that, because we get really caught up in what we're doing in the practices, and sometimes it's nice to take a step back and just look at big picture. And so that's what we're going to do today, and just, you know, just kind of take a breather here and really look and see how we can tune things up without getting crazy. I think I've come up with about 10 of them, so some of the common mistakes here. Number one, and I've mentioned this one before, I've actually had a webinar series, a couple of them on it, but when we were looking at hidden revenue, I've talked about moderate sedation. But I don't want to talk about how to code for it or anything. Everybody knows that, you know, it's the 99152 code for the most part. But here's something that's interesting, is that I got not just a reader question, but I'm starting to see more denials. And a lot of my clients are saying, Terry, we're getting denied for these, you know, for anything that has to do with moderate sedation, and we're not sure why. So I'm taking a look at some of this, and it's only a $6 to $12 reimbursed code. Okay, that doesn't seem like much, but if you're constantly getting it denied, do the math. That can be a problem if you engage in your moderate sedation or conscious sedation services, and you're the one that's basically doing the supervision from the sedation trained nurse. So what I'm finding is most of things that are in the report says something like sedation, colon, moderate conscious sedation performed by sedation trained nurse with, you know, what the milligrams are of fentanyl and the milligrams of Versed, time in, time out. And they've met the time criteria. So what I found with two payers, and these are commercial plans and every payer is different, but they want to see something that says, and I actually have put this out there as far as wording and just put it in as a macro or a script, but they want to see something that's a little bit more specific. So it needs to say, I attest that moderate conscious sedation was provided under my direct supervision with a sedation-trained independent nurse, and then go into the medicines and the time in, time out, and then you can refer back to the nurse's sheet. But in talking to these payers and just trying to follow up and figure out, you know, what is going on, yes, it sounds nitpicky, but just think that one little thing, how that can make such a big impact. So basically, you need to say that it's under your supervision, and then you can get your $6 to $12. But I know that sounds I know some of you are thinking, just that little thing. I'm sorry, but that's what they want. And if that's what they want, that's what we have to give them. So we really just don't want to basically skimp on that if we can help it. One of the other things that's been going on, and I know a lot of you are dealing with what we call MIPS and MACRA, and I've mentioned those acronyms before, but it really has to do with quality measures. Well, another acronym talks about HCCs, and those are hierarchical condition coding, meaning that the category of medical conditions that physicians have basically maps over to a specific code set in ICD-10, and that's how you're basically looked at paid for performance. Well, what's happening is that what this can do is it can really help skilled coders assign accurate codes and to document certain things in the chart. But, and it's a part of risk adjustment, but what I'm seeing is that a lot of these diagnoses don't even qualify as HCC codes. And that's what can be a problem, because you're trying to, you know, get paid on certain things that are diagnosis related, and we're just not seeing that that is helpful. So make sure that you're getting the list. If you type in and Google it, you can Google it, just put in HCC diagnosis, and it'll give you the definition of the acronym, and it'll give you CMS, Medicare's list of what qualifies from that hierarchical coding list, what conditions qualify, and that will help you with any of your payment for performance issues. So that's number two, and I know those two were kind of technical, but we really have to just look at that from the big picture, otherwise it can be a problem. Now another one, and I'm going to go in a different direction, I'll come back to coding too, but this one, I don't know if you realize this, but when you're thinking about, you know, wow, we've been having maybe a dip in patients, or maybe you're thinking that you haven't seen a lot of new patients lately, or maybe a patient you expected to come in recently hasn't been there in a while. Well, don't underestimate the impact of social media. Okay, I always say, you know, social media is the fire, but when you look at that, there's like gasoline poured on it. So basically, social media has your new patient population and what patients think about their caregivers. They look at Google, Yelp, TripAdvisor, and basically you need to have a staff person that's regularly checking your social media, and this will let you know why traffic is down. I know that I post on Yelp and I post on certain sites if I think that I've gotten bad service, but I also post if I think I got great service as well. So I do give both sides of it, but some people don't. They just post a bad comment. So you want to really make sure you're understanding what's going on in that realm. So just have somebody check it. I've had a lot of different businesses say, oh my gosh, we thought we were a five-star business. And then they take a look and they find out that they've been given a lot of one stars, which takes down their credibility, and somebody will just move on to somebody else. So everybody's really engaged now with social media. And if you think they aren't, you're really not into what today's world is. So it has a huge impact. Just remember, in that scenario, you know, content is fire, but social media can be gasoline sometimes, and you just want to make sure that it's going in your direction. Number four is under documentation that you won't be able to appeal. Now, I see this a lot in computer-assisted coding. I mentioned that a couple of months ago on a podcast. We call it CAC. But the biggest thing that I see actually deficient would be no doctor signatures and no authentication of the record. So they haven't closed it out, it's left the building, and somebody says, can I have a signature? And you know, sometimes I know that sounds silly now that we are in the digital age and everything is typically, or I should say most practices are now in electronic medical records, but that doesn't mean you still don't have to have a signature. Some practices have now actually an electronic signature that comes up the physician's name and their actual signature. Some other practices have just say, electronically authenticated with the doctor's name. That's okay too. I like the other better. But you just have to make sure that you know that documentation can really, you know, support what's leaving the office. And so that's a huge mistake. I can't tell you how much Medicare likes to ask for refunds based on that. Another issue is with chronic care management, and I know, again, I've done a podcast on this, I've done three webinars I've done more audits, it seems like, on this topic than anywhere, and Medicare is taking so much money back. 20 minutes is really, for per month, is what's necessary, and it's clinical time with the patient for any chronic care management code, 99490. But what's happening is that some of the third-party companies are out there, and they're putting in kind of this filler discussions and calling it clinical when it's not clinical people actually performing the service, and they're having what they call community discussions to hit the time thresholds. And you're not always going to hit time thresholds with patients. You're not always going to get a hold of them from a phone call that's offsite on a telehealth type service. And so be careful of falling into that trap. It's like somebody saying, you know, your CPT book says, well, this service is for 15 minutes, so every single patient you say has 15 minutes of it. Well, that looks suspect. Not everybody's going to have that. I had a doctor recently that had critical care time, and he was a critical care physician, but he basically put in his note, and he saw 30 patients that day, and he said everybody had at least an hour of critical care time. Well, how many hours are in a given day? 24. So how can you have 30 hours of anything? You know, do the math. So be careful with that, because it can get you into some trouble, and I don't want you to get into trouble. Now, modifiers, as we know, are your key to reimbursement. They play a big role when it comes to coding and billing and processes. So I'm in the middle of this one audit right now, and it's an EP audit, which is the it's electrophysiology. So that's pacemakers and ablations. And remember, EP is the computer of the heart, not how blood flows through the heart. So a little bit different as far as what the procedures do. But I noticed a pattern on the procedures where they were adding a 51 or a 59 to add-on codes. And those are the codes in your CPT book that have a plus sign in front of them. You don't want to do that. There's a reason there's a plus sign, and there's a reason they're paid lower than a regular code on a fee schedule, a regular Category 1 code. It's because they are a add-on code, meaning that they have to have a primary procedure to even be reported to a payer. So they're modifier exempt from that. So if you add the modifier, you could pend your claim. And then also I had another one where the codes were not in order. So remember, codes should be listed in what we call RVU order, meaning in descending orders, the highest valued procedure is first, and then the lower valued procedure is listed underneath, and so on. But I monitor some EOBs from different practices and say, let me take a look. And I notice lower payments than what the contract allowed as well. So unnecessary denials for, it says, incorrect modifier. And the practice wrote off a lot, saying it wasn't collectible, which, you know, they needed to go back and send a corrected claim. But I found almost $20,000 in this one audit in lost revenue because they took what the insurance company said is at face value. And so you have to be careful with that. Otherwise, you're basically buying into what they're saying. And if, you know, if I was an attorney, I'd make an argument for that and basically say, well, they were fine with it, so why should they be able to come back at a later time and try to get that paid? So you have to be really careful with modifiers. You know, the 51 modifier and 59 is exempt on add-on codes. The 25 modifier, now I've talked about this, as far as be careful, because if you put that on an E&M service, which are the evaluation and management codes, along with a minor procedure, you may get a 50% reduction on your visit for the day because of what all the payers are saying about that now. And then I saw one today where I had one of my clients, they sent me an email question and said, I don't understand what's wrong with this claim. It was for an intravascular ultrasound billed with a heart cath. And they said, I don't understand why I'm getting a denial for no modifier. And I looked at it and I said, okay, well, this is a two-component code. You're billing for it in the hospital or facility setting, so you need a 26 modifier, as the hospital will use a TC modifier, which is the technical component. And they're like, well, I've never done that before, and I got paid. And I said, well, let's take a look. And you could tell at that time the insurance company decided, well, we're going to just assign it. Don't rely on them to do your job. So you definitely have to make sure it's done on the front end. Sometimes they'll put it on there just based on your address, but most of the time they're not going to help you out. So you want to put that on for yourself. One of the other mistakes I see a lot is ordering a test that your physician deemed necessary from a discussion with the patient, but the discussion isn't part of the medical record. It never made it into the documentation. So what I'll see a lot of times is I'll see the chart will notes will say something to the effect that no chest pain, no shortness of breath, no evidence of ischemic heart disease. And then at the very end, I'll see in the plan of care, the medical decision making, they're ordering a nuclear stress test. Okay, well, that's to find ischemia. That's to find problems with the heart on the backside. And I'm thinking, okay, first of all, you say the patient doesn't have any problem here, and now you're ordering a test. So really just hammer home on your physicians, and for any of the physicians that are engaged in the podcast, remember, everything is about medical necessity, clear indications, understanding that you have to go from point A to B, you have to start at point A. So you have to have a reason to do anything. Otherwise, it's not considered medically necessary. So always keep that in mind as you're moving on with your processes and with your ordering. Especially, let me just say a side note on that, especially if you're a physician who gets paid by RVU. That came up in a proposal. I was talking to a company today that's looking to engage some of my services. And they said, our physicians are paid by RVU, so we want to be sensitive to the fact that we don't want to tell them anything that's going to show the lower coding. And I went, okay, wait a minute, then I'm not the person for you. I'm going to show them how to compliant code, how to make sure they can support every level of service, but you would not engage me to say, how do I get to a level 5? I would never have that discussion with the patient, with the physician. My discussion would be, okay, so here's a level 2, here's a level 3, 4, 5, on an ENM is what I'm talking about. And then if the doctor says, well, I do that and I do that, I said, okay, let's have more of a discussion. Give me a scenario on one of your patients and tell me what the process is. Or let me shadow you and I'll let you know what you're missing or what you're not based on the presenting problem, not based on how do I beef up my documentation so I can get a higher level of service. So those kinds of things you have to be very careful of, or it can definitely be a problem. So just be kind of careful when you're ordering something or doing something that isn't well documented. Now, number 8, and actually before I get into number 8, I wanted to mention, go back to our sponsor, ID City. So what they have on Wednesday, June 20th to the 22nd, is they have a world conference, and the agenda talks about, it's actually called Worlds in Collision. They talk about artificial intelligence, they're big on robotic surgery and robot makers, blockchain world. I don't think I'm going to listen to that one, but they have healthcare 2.0, the cannabis revolution, really, freedom of speech and political correctness. That's all over social media and what we can do there. So just something there to keep in mind if you're interested in them. So again, we want to thank them, Idea City. It's hard to say. Okay, so now let's get into number 8. This is non-friendly doctor's waiting room. So I have someone that I've been talking to quite a bit lately. She's just really just a sweet person. Her name's Corinne, and she has 2 kids, and they're younger kids. And we were talking about how tough it is as a mom to take a child into, a sick child into a waiting room, but you have to bring your other child with you and what to do there. So it's not just about TVs and refrigerators and coffee stations and all that. But if you are a pediatric practice, or if you are an OB-GYN practice, or let's say any practice that you know that patients bring their kids in there because they don't have childcare, make sure that you have something for them that can help engage the kids. Not everybody brings books, and even books, now the parent with the sick child is sitting there having to deal with the child who's not feeling well, but then the well child is jumping off the walls wanting you to read to them, and you're trying to tell them to be quiet. But consider this, have some kind of a chalkboard on the wall. Have a Lego wall. Have something that they can do that doesn't take parent interaction, but the parent can keep an eye on them. So just have an art table, something that can be self-contained. But I strongly recommend you do that, because your outcomes and your patient satisfaction surveys are going to be so much better if you can really kind of relate to those kinds of patients. I know sometimes you don't think about that, but that's really big. The next one, number 9, is not collecting copays. So if you want to get me in a grumpy mood, that is the first thing I see when I walk into some practices, is the patient's actually there, and I'll see some front desk people engaging in personal conversations, but not collecting those copays as the patient enters the office. As they sign in, that should be looked at in their account. Think about this if you go to the gym. when you go to the gym, you have to put in your fingerprint now. And then what comes up is a screen that says if you're current on your account. And if you're not, you don't get to go into the gym, or they say, you know, can you go ahead and update this with a credit card right now? Same thing when you go to the grocery store. You can't get your groceries unless you pay your bill. Well, the doctor's office should be no different than that. If you're going to engage in my services, you have to pay your out-of-pocket while you're here. And you want to make sure that you have people that are not afraid to ask for any kind of money. So that's the one thing that really drives me insane, is that when the patient's in the office, you want to be able to utilize their presence to get your money from them. And always, you know, if you know prior to them coming in, you know, definitely leave them a message so that they know to bring money with them. It doesn't work for me when somebody says, well, I don't have my checkbook. Everybody has a wallet with them because they need their ID to get in, and they should have some kind of a debit card, credit card, or an avenue of payment. And if not, in a cheery face, say, you know what, can you run out to your car to get that? Because they're driving there. We really need to get a payment on your account today. That would be great. Make it very, very pleasant. But if they have that and they're coming in your office, you need to make sure that you're collecting that. Otherwise, it just costs you money once they leave the office. Number 10, and this one is kind of interesting here. So not being current. And I say that because whenever I do a speaking engagement, or I'll do a seminar, or I'm doing some kind of an educational in person, I'll get somebody that'll say, well, I'm trying to bill for, and I'll give you a good example that happened recently. And for those of you that are engaged and, you know, are updated, I hope you find this just as unfortunately amusing as I do. And I felt for the gal, because she just really was new to some certain things. So she basically said, you know, I'm trying to bill for consult codes, and they keep getting denied. And I said, well, what's your payer? And she said, Medicare. Well, Medicare hasn't acknowledged the consult codes. They took them off the fee schedule since 2010. So for 8 years ago. And I said, have you been out of healthcare for a while? And she said, no, I'm just now coding. So that was a little bit frightening to me, because you need to know your rules. And, you know, you need to know what's updated. Things are updated all the time when it comes to coding and billing, as you know. And make sure if you hire somebody, that let's say somebody says, you know, I've been in cardiology for years. I haven't done it in the last 5 years, but I know what I'm doing. Well, that would be an inaccurate statement unless they've been purchasing their CPT book every year for the last 5 years. So for example, if you're part of the cardiology specialty, you would know that in 2011 they overhauled over 200 codes. And then they changed again for peripheral vascular in 2012. And it's just an ongoing process. In 2018, for example, they changed all of the aneurysm repair codes. So I've had to, you know, research and make sure that those are all accurate. So really not being updated is a problem, because those little things of thinking you could bill something that was last year, you can't anymore. You know, anticoag codes. So if you have a patient who's on blood thinners and warfarin, used to be able to bill if it was necessary, a minor nurse visit, and then plus the 85610, which is for the PATH part of the ProTime and the blood draw. But now they have completely different codes that you engage in that talk about the warfarin check. So you have to be updated. Make sure you're updated. Otherwise, that's going to be a problem, and can really, that those simple mistakes can cost you a lot of money. So we always end with a coding question, and this coding question is a little bit controversial, and I hope everybody appreciates that I'm engaging in a controversial topic, and it won't deter you from listening in again, regardless of your political affiliation, your feeling about it, your acceptance or non-acceptance about it. It's part of the medical coding process now. So I've had some questions on this, and I've had to do some research. And I felt that this was something maybe in today's climate that you would find interesting, even if you didn't understand it. And hopefully, when you're listening to it, you can understand that it is definitely a sensitive subject. So I got a question from a practice in Texas, and they said, Terry, we are really having a hard time because in our practice, we deal with the transgender population. And I know there's now some coding issues with that. So can you help us, because we're just not understanding what we can or can't do along this line, and we're really just trying to make sure that we're coding correctly. Okay, so transgender is a broad term, and it's used for people whose gender identity or gender expression differs from their assigned sex at birth. So proper diagnosis and procedural coding of transgender medical services first begins with the understanding of the spectrum of gender identity variations. So here are some of the definitions. Let me just start there quick, and then I'll go into some of the coding. So although there's no universally accepted definition of the word transgender, here are some of the terms you should know when you're dealing with coding patients with gender, what they call dysphoria. So bigendered, those are individuals who identify as both or alternatively male and female as no gender or as gender outside the male or female binary. Crossdresser, individuals who dress in clothing associated with the opposite sex for reasons that include a need to express femininity or masculinity, artistic expression, performance, or erotic pleasure, but do not identify as that gender. The term transvestite was previously used to describe a crossdresser, but it's now considered derogatory and should not be used. Female to male, FTM, you'll see that acronym. Someone who was identified as female at birth, but identifies and portrays his gender as male. This term is often used after the individual has taken some steps to express his gender as male or after medically transitioning through hormones or surgery, aka trans man. Gender identity, a person's innate identification as a man, woman, or something else that may or may not correspond to the person's external body or assigned sex at birth. Intersex, individuals with a set of congenital variations of the reproductive systems that are not considered typical for either male or female. This includes newborns with ambiguous genitalia, a condition that affects 1 in 2,000 newborns in the United States each year, actually. Male to female, MTF, someone who is identified as male at birth but identifies and portrays her gender as female. This term is often used after the individual has taken some steps to express her gender as female or after medically transitioning through hormones or surgery, trans woman. And lastly would be transsexual, an individual who strongly identifies with the other sex and seeks hormones or gender affirmation surgery or both to feminize or masculinize the body. This person may live full time in the cross gender role. Okay, so here's some criteria for payers to cover gender reassignment. Like all other procedures, it has to be medically necessary and proven, and there has to be evidence of a strong and persistent cross-gender identification. So meaning that the individual is insistent on being the other sex, and there's other things that involve there as well. This cross-gender identification must not merely be a desire for perceived cultural advantages of being the other sex, and that's something that the doctor's going to have to deal with. There must be evidence of persistent discomfort about the patient's assigned sex or a sense of inappropriateness in the gender role of that sex. So transgender diagnosis is not made if the individual has a concurrent physical intersex condition. So androgen insensitivity syndrome or congenital adrenal hyperplasia. To make the diagnosis, there must be evidence of clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning in daily life. So one of the health plans, as I was researching this question, Tufts Health Plan, for example, and you can get this online, they offer coverage if, one, the patient is 18 years of age or older, the patient has a definite diagnosis of persistent gender dysphoria that has been documented by a qualified licensed mental health professional, such as a psychiatrist, psychologist, or other licensed physician experienced in the field. The patient has received continuous hormone therapy for 12 months or more under the supervision of a physician. The patient has lived as their assigned gender full-time for 12 months or more. Okay, and the patient's medical and mental health providers document that there's no contraindications to the planned surgery and agree with the plan within 3 months of prior authorization request. So this is a lot to, I know, understand. And so the only other thing I'm going to say about this as far as coding, ICD-10 codes tied to gender transition start at F64.0 to F64.9. So it starts at transsexualism down to gender identity disorder unspecified. And then when you get into procedural coding, although there's no specific procedure code for people diagnosed with gender dysphoria, who are choosing to transition, there are two CPT codes that pertain to intersex surgery. One is 55970, intersex surgery male to female, and 55980, intersex surgery male to female. So there's other codes that, you know, that's not a comprehensive list, that go into vaginectomy, urethroplasty, and so forth. And those codes, you know, you definitely can look up. That's after the gender surgery, transition surgery is performed. But that's to get you started. But hopefully you'll understand that I just felt it was necessary. I got the coding question to just bring this up in a podcast. And hopefully I was sensitive enough to the topic not to offend anybody, and just realize that it is part of the medical community now as we talk about these services. Okay, and just our last thing, we just again want to thank Idea City. See, I said it right this time. The Brightest Minds, and again, their World in Collision in conference is going to be June 20th through the 22nd. So we appreciate them as our sponsor today, as the CodeCast podcast is brought to you by them. So everyone, I hope you go out and make it a great day. And remember, the next time we'll be on will be for our Top 10 Tuesday. So that'll be at the end of the month. And we hope you enjoy today's CodeCast podcast. Thank you again for listening, and make it a great day.
For more information on medical coding, billing, auditing, and compliance, including how to hire Terry, follow Terry on Twitter at TerryCoder1 or visit her website at www.terryfletcher.net. Podcast producer Joe Kuzma. Music producer Dasassin Music.